episode is brought to you by Apeel. Apeel is a plant-based protective layer that helps produce last up to twice as long. Learn more at Apeel.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're spotlighting the people, dishes, and ingredients decolonizing food. We're looking at our Thanksgiving plates and beyond to explore efforts to reclaim food sovereignty in Native American culture, the African diaspora, and Puerto Rico.
I believe that oyster dressing is like the consummate side dish for an amazing fried turkey.
What we're doing there is just working the land, and we're laughing, and we're creating a space for joy. And it's in that healing occurs for us.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts. Right, hello, this is Lisa Held, and you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. My guest today is Tom Philpott. He is one of the most renowned journalists in the country covering the intersection of food, agriculture, and the environment. I could not be more excited to have Tom on the show, as he is somebody who covers a lot of what I do, and it's just really exciting to talk to somebody doing something similar. He's currently the food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones and previously worked as a writer and editor at Grist. And he's here today to talk about his new book, Perilous Bounty: The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Lisa.
As you heard me say, I'm so excited to have you, and also want to say congratulations on the book release. It's kind of a crazy year to have a book coming out, I would imagine.
It is. It makes it in some ways a little bit easier because everything I do is via, you know, like sort of bookstore appearances are all via Zoom. So none of this, you know, crazy traveling, but,
right.
So I in some senses I'm happy about that, but in other senses it would be good to get out there a little bit more and, you know, talk to people about the book face to face.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll do what we can, in this radio format for now. So one reason I just finished the book, and one reason I think, it's really important is that generally, when we talk about the ways in which the food system causes ecological destruction, you know, whether it's in the form of water pollution, greenhouse gas emissions, soil degradation, all of these things, defenders of industrial agriculture will say these impacts are inevitable because we have to feed the world. There's a sense that they're necessary evils in order to produce enough food, right?
Yeah.
But your kind of central thesis is that this way of doing things, producing as much as possible in these efficient centralized systems, actually threatens our ability to feed the world. Why?
Yeah, I mean, that is like this this central paradox. And I remember reading something, 10 or so years ago that really caught my eye. It was like the framing was, can sustainable agriculture feed the world? And if you think about a statement like that, it's like, well, can unsustainable agriculture feed the world, and for how long? And right. When you look at sort of what makes the kind of agriculture we do unsustainable, you know, the answer that you get is, well, not for very long, because, as I show in the book, in the places, you know, I focus on two places, but this really, you know, the California Central Valley and the Corn Belt centered in Iowa. But it's really true of any place you look at where agriculture gets really intensive. There are many places in the country like that, many places in the world. Mm-hmm. Essentially, what you end up doing is consuming the very resources that make it a great place to grow food in the first place. And when you've done that, then, you know, you've tapped out this resource and you're not feeding the world anymore. And so I think that, you know, that is something that we have to grapple with. And that, and I hope my book makes people think a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I really like that framing that you use too, because it's kind of funny how it's just another example of how the word sustainable is kind of meaningless at this point, because wouldn't that be the whole, like, if it's sustainable, it has to feed the world, because the whole point is that it's going to continue to sustain us, right?
Exactly. Like,
it's kind of a crazy, we sort of just use that word to mean something kind of incomprehensible at this point. So you talk about, a lot about the Midwest and the corn, soy, hog systems and the effects of nutrient losses there, which I know more about and I've covered a little bit over the years. But I was genuinely shocked by your reporting on water in California, especially in the Central Valley. Let's talk a little bit about that. The flood, the Great Flood of 1862. When did you first hear about that?
I first heard about it when I was first digging into the research for the book. So I'd already decided on the two areas, and I had done a bunch of work on California droughts. I think the drought probably had just ended when I was sort of digging into the research around the book. And I was just astonished to find that in addition to there being the threat of bigger and longer and more severe droughts going forward, almost, you know, completely baked into the cake by climate change, there paradoxically is also the threat of a massive mega flood that is really hard to get our minds around the scale of. And there's actually a precedent that is largely forgotten, and that is the California flood of 1861-62. So what happens, basically what happens is it starts raining in December in 1861 on the entire west coast of the United States and doesn't stop for 40 days and 40, literally out of the Bible, like a biblical flood, 40 days and 40 nights. Wow. And yeah, so I heard about it and I was like, there is some work being done on it in California. There's a great academic named B. Lynn Ingram. She's a professor of paleoclimatology at Berkeley. And I started digging into this entire world and I, you know, came away from it fascinated and terrified.
Yeah. Well, and the research that you mentioned, it seems like there is quite a bit happening and that there, you know, finding a lot of evidence that the likelihood of another flood of this magnitude is quite high. And I mean, I hadn't heard that ever. Why do you think that that hasn't been more widely reported?
Yeah, I mean, just so we make sure the listeners understand the scale. So we're talking about a flood that could put the entire Central Valley, which stretches from, you know, not that far north of Los Angeles, up to the northern border of the state, you know, toward the Oregon border. So you're talking about, you know, 300 mile long territory, 50, 60 mile wide territory under, 20 feet of water in an area that in 1861 was pretty sparsely populated. There weren't urban centers there. There were Native American populations who actually fled before the flood really developed. Versus today where you've got Fresno and Stockton and all of these fast growing cities. And so I think, you know, the question of why isn't this more famous, I think it's just harder to envision something like that happening, where we can envision earthquakes because they happen with some regularity out there. And, you know, anyone who was born after 1980 can remember, you know, the massive earthquake that happened in California. I'm sorry, in the Bay Area. But it's hard. I mean, this is something out of a disaster movie. And yeah. I think it's just really hard to think about it in a concrete way. And so people just don't think about it.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of typical of some of these things we try to talk about when we talk about climate change, the climate crisis. Some of the impacts are just so hard to even imagine, right? There's like a cognitive dissonance that says like you can't even fathom something of that magnitude. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned how large the Central Valley is and what would be affected if a flood of this size were to happen again. What would that mean for the food system based on the reporting you did?
Yeah. So, I mean, you just have to think about how much food we get from that region, from that sort of bowl in the middle of California. And, you know, it's something on order of like a fifth or a quarter of the food that we eat in this country, fruits and vegetables, nuts, huge amounts of milk come from there. There's beef production. It's the biggest milk production. California's the biggest milk producing state. And most of the milk production happens in the Central Valley. It happens in California. Mm. And so, you know, you're talking about an incredible disruption in, you know, that year's crops that would, you know, there would be a scramble to make up for it. There would definitely be higher prices. There'd be a scramble to import. And then you're also talking about millions and millions of dollars in investments made in things like almond groves, that pistachio groves. These are investments that people make that take place over 25 years. They're very expensive to put in. And so, you know, you're talking about potentially killing off, you know, this massive base of almond and pistachio groves. And then, you know, something else that you got to think about is all of the farm chemicals, all of the manure from this, you know, I mean, we're talking about giant industrial scale milk factory farms, factory dairy uh-huh. farms, all of that material, you know, getting taken up into water, and then as it dries up, just sort of sinking. You know, think of all the pesticides and fertilizers that are always on hand in an area like that. And it's you know, like the academics who modeled out what a storm would look like, really did not get much further than to sort of gape at what could possibly happen. And I think, you know, once again, this is just like, you know, how do you model something like that? Like, you know, has there, you know, something like that really hasn't happened in the modern world where a, you know, probably, you know, possibly that one of the two or three most industrialized agriculture centers on the globe coming under 20 feet of water. So it's really hard to model, but what we can say is that it would completely screw things up for many years in one of the key nodes of food production in the United States and in the world.
Right. Well, and I guess, you know, another reason maybe more attention isn't paid to this is, you know, as you document in the book, the problem of drought is so front and center and present that the region is dealing with that on a daily basis and trying to figure out where to get more water. So maybe the idea of even thinking about the prospect of a flood is kind of foreign, you know?
Yeah, that's definitely true. And there actually are some scary trade-offs on that very question, because one of the things that people want to do to make more water available to farms in the Central Valley is to build more dams. And, and you know, that's not really a viable solution, because, you know, when you talk to water experts in California, the dams are like the good dams are already built. Like the places that are, you know, optimal for putting a dam, and especially a large dam, there are already dams there. Anything, you know, there isn't a whole lot of more water storage to be wrung out of the area. But whenever you build them, you're sort of putting more pressure on a possible sudden, you know, deluge of water. And so, it, you know, those two goals don't, you know, flood control and making water available for agriculture are often competing goals. And of course, in the Central Valley, the push is always to, you know, grab more water.
Right. Yeah. So there's a lot happening in the Central Valley that, you know, that we really all should be worried about. But let's move to the Midwest for a little bit. So the problem that you focused on was really soil loss as kind of the foundation. Why did you choose that particular angle when looking at the Midwest agricultural system?
It's funny because it was influenced by California, because, you know, really the idea for the book germinated with California, just sort of like thinking about here is this this jewel of our food system, this linchpin of our food system, and essentially we're drawing down fossil water, water that can't be replaced in our lifetimes to feed ourselves. And there's this race to the bottom of the aquifer going on there that there's no good end to. You know, beyond the solution I came up with in the book of like sort of building up regional food systems elsewhere. And so while I'm contemplating that, and I was actually thinking about a book on California itself, just focusing on that area, I started reading about these big storms that were happening in the spring of 2013. And so, as you know, as a reporter who covers this stuff very well, I should add, as you know, after the harvest of corn and soybeans in the fall and before the next year's crop comes up, there's this period of many months where the ground is essentially just bare. And it's during this period where the Midwest is getting these bigger and bigger and more intense storms. And so one of the, you know, so there's 2013 was a really bad year for that. There was massive amounts of soil loss because, you know, essentially the soil just washes away being unprotected by vegetation. I came across a scientist named Rick Cruz out of Iowa State University. And he was just sort of casually talking about catastrophic amounts of soil loss that, you know, they're worse some years than others. But when you average them out, they're extreme. You know, there's a situation where the Midwest soil, which is this incredible resource, is essentially being spent. And so I'm thinking to myself, well, we're drawing down fossil water in California at this, you know, insane pace, and we're doing something really similar to soil in the Midwest. This is a real problem for our food system. And so that's sort of why, you know, I had water on the mind as a finite resource in California. And then I see this other equally or more important region with this other finite resource that is also expending it. And, you know, in both cases, these are the foundations of food production. Like, you don't have agriculture in California without abundant water because it's a Mediterranean climate. And you don't have, you know, this highly productive agriculture in the Midwest without this sort of lush blanket of soil that, you know, we encountered, you know, American settlers encountered in the mid-19th century.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a interesting parallel, and I think it's also helps people understand kind of the varied problems or the varied challenges of producing food in different places. You know, I think like we often don't think about how what should be produced where and how much you know, the climate, the soil, the water availability of a place matter when you decide what to grow. You know.
Yep. Yeah. That's exactly right.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about solutions. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Appeal. Here at HRN, we care about reducing waste across our food system, from farms to home kitchens. We know that about half of the produce we grow ends up in the trash. We want to enjoy produce at peak freshness and reduce the amount that gets thrown away. That's where Appeal comes in. Appeal is a plant-based protective layer that helps produce last up to twice as long. It's edible, invisible, and imitates how peels naturally protect fruits and vegetables. Because here's the thing, less waste doesn't just mean we're throwing less food away. It also means we waste less water, energy, and other resources that go into growing produce. Appeal works with nature to reduce waste across the food system, from the farm to the kitchen. Appeal helps us conserve our precious resources to ensure we have fresh food to meet our growing needs. Appeal, food gone good. Learn more at appeal.com.
The Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture will be hosting their annual Young Farmers and Cooks Conference virtually this year on December 8th through 10th. Programming will cover topics like mutual aid, regional grain economies, land management practices, and much, much more. Whether you're a farmer, cook, butcher, miller, preservationist, processor, or anyone else in the food chain, this conference is for you. Learn more at stonebarncenter.org/YFCC.
All right, we're back. This is Lisa Held. You're listening to The Farm Report. I've been talking to veteran food and agriculture journalist Tom Philpott, author of the new book, Perilous Bounty. So, Tom, we talked about a lot of problems that are happening in the food system before the break, and it can feel a little overwhelming. Actually, my first question is kind of, I am going to ask you about solutions, but I'm actually still thinking of another kind of problem of its own. But, you know, you talk in the book about the kind of Michael Pollan-driven food movement. You mentioned it in the beginning and then again in the end, and how it's led to an increase in local and regional food sales, which, you know, arguably can be good for the environment and local economies. But it hasn't really at all slowed business as usual in the overall industrial food system as we know it. What did you learn in reporting this book about why that might be? Like why that quote unquote movement hasn't had a bigger impact on shifting the bigger system?
So in the writing of the book, I also had because I've been doing this since I think I started writing about food politics like around 2005. So just a year before Omnivore's Dilemma came out.
Right.
And so that book casts a really long shadow, and it's kind of a landmark of, there was a before and after in that book. I think it really galvanized people to think about where their food's coming from, to, you know, there's already a kind of a farmer's market boom going on that it certainly threw gasoline onto, sort of made it burn brighter. And so something else I did in the conclusion of the book was I kind of took stock of that movement and where it's gotten us. You know, I was very much a part of it. Like I moved from Brooklyn in 2004 to a small farm in North Carolina.
Classic story.
You know, yeah, very, very, very classic story. Small farm in Appalachia, North Carolina, because I was really interested in food and where it came from and being part of a movement to change things. And, you know, I was in a CSA in Brooklyn before that, community gardener. And so, you know, what I realized is that, you know, Pollan talked about a market as movement and voting with your fork three times a day as transformational techniques. Like we are going to, you know, as consumers, we're going to band together and transform this. And, you know, a bunch of people took up the call, and that there has been this explosion of farmers markets. But I think what it's, but you know, as you say, you know, industrial agriculture proceeded apace. You know, all these companies that I talk about in the book, your Monsanto's, which got bought by Bayer, all these companies, you know, minted millions of dollars for their shareholders over the same period. All the problems that you and I write about continued, the sort of, you know, dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
Right.
And, you know, all of these, you know, features that we write about, everything continued. Exploitation of labor in the food system, you know, the veil of that ripped off by the coronavirus crisis. And so what I realized is that the sort of consumer in an incredibly unequal society where there's so much income inequality and wealth inequality, that you've got a small, relatively small set of consumers who can afford to vote with their forks and make, quote unquote, make better decisions. Mm-hmm. It's going to lead to a very, very limited response. And this is something that I was actually writing about in the mid-2000s when I first got into it, that there was a danger of, instead of transforming the industrial food system, what we'd achieve would be to create two food systems. This one that is very nice if you're able to live inside it. If you're able to live by Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn and shop at the Brooklyn, you know, Park Slope Food Co-op, it feels like you live in this transformed world, but that ends up being a food system primarily for fairly well-off people. And by having an alternative, you're almost even strengthening industrial food system, because you're sort of like letting off steam. You're channeling discontent with it in this other direction. And, you know, I just realized that that's essentially, in the writing of this book, that's essentially what we've done. We've created two food systems, and now is the time to work on transforming the dominant food system. And, you know, where I end up in the book is that that's going to require social movements. It's going to require, you know, not just voting with your fork, but also voting with your feet, getting out in the street, because these, you know, these companies that profit from it are smart, and they, you know, take some of their profits and invest it in lobbying and campaign finance, and they really have a stronghold on the political system. And that ends up what we have to transform. So I just feel like, no, I just concluded that we came to the limits of the Michael Pollan revolution.
Yeah. Well, and you seem pretty optimistic about the power of the vote in the end, of voting, you know, with your vote, not your fork. I was kind of surprised by that. I'm maybe more of a pessimist. I feel like, you know, under every administration of the last several decades, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, the Farm Bill has largely remained the same and propped up the system that we're talking about. Like, how will voting with your vote potentially lead to a change in this system?
Well, yeah, I mean, I finished my book at a very particular moment in American in the American drama, and that was that 5-minute period when Bernie Sanders was... when I finished it, Bernie Sanders had a lot of momentum and Liz Warren had a lot of momentum, and Joe Biden was scraping bottom. And so it seemed like maybe one of those two, both of them had really transformative, you know, ag agendas that they were putting out. They both did very well in Iowa. I think that was right around the time I was finishing up. And so, it did seem for that moment. And I think now we are right back in the middle of where you're talking about, especially, you know, also with Congress. And I think that, like, what is going to be required is social movements. And I just want to give a quick example. And that is that in India right now, today, the government, they've got a very right wing kind of Trumpist government. And one of the things that that governor, that Prime Minister Modi is doing, is he's putting into effect some neoliberal reforms to agricultural policy that is basically going to put, you know, it's basically going to harm literally millions of small scale and medium scale farmers. And they are, so, I mean, these are very different situations, because we, you know, our farming populations are rounding error. You know, it's like 2% of our, less than 2% of our population. There it's much, much, much higher. So I'm not saying these are parallel situations.
Right.
But their farming sector, their small and mid-scale farms, non-industrial scale farms, have formed a movement, and they are literally blocking traffic in, they've marched to, you know, the Capitol, and are blocking traffic and are in a standoff with the cops. And Modi, Prime Minister Modi, has not very much choice but to figure out some way to compromise with them. And I think that that is the sort of thing that, okay, we don't have the farm population to do that. Like, if every one of our farmers marched on Washington, I mean, like, if the same percentage of our farmers marched on Washington as their farmers are marching on their capital, it would be a tiny number.
Yeah.
But we as people, because we have a stake in the food system, we have a stake in having a healthy farm system, those are the kinds of things that we're going to have to do. We're going to have to make, you know, there's these, if you're a politician in Washington, you've got pressure from this lobby and that lobby, and you've got pressure from the population in your state or your district who are voting for you. And the voting pressures tend to be pretty light compared to these special interests. And we need to add another interest into the soup there. And that is, you know, political action, social movements, people getting out on the street. I really believe this. I mean, I think that any gains that we get in climate change are going to be because there's been a climate movement. And I think that climate change and food are the same issue, really. I mean, food is part of the same issue as climate change. And a broader climate movement demanding solutions, demanding the end of business as usual, is what it's going to take. And I know that in the U.S. context, that's very far-fetched. But then I also think about, in the last decade, Occupy Wall Street, two major Black Lives Matter uprisings.
Right.
Many union uprisings, Chicago teachers' unions. We have seen political action in the streets making change here. And I think that the food system is going to have to take a – food system reformers are going to have to take a lesson from that.
Yeah. Do you think it matters that in the U.S. there's so much division, seems like maybe the wrong word, but to me it does feel like that farmers are not united in, you know, in terms of their interests. Like it sometimes, you know, we're talking about farmers' interests, we're talking about farmers who are kind of aligning themselves with the interests of corporate agribusiness, right? And then other times it's, you know, the interests of a small dairy farmer in Vermont who has 100 cows. And it's hard to see kind of a coming together of people around this issue because the thinking and the you know, is so different depending on who the farmer is.
Yeah, and you know, also it also has to be said that like what Modi is trying to do in India was done here 100 years ago. You know, basically clearing the land of farmers and, you know, consolidating farmland into fewer and fewer, larger and larger hands.
So those interests exist there too. Yeah.
And so it's hard for us to have an agrarian movement like they have in India or they have in a place like Mexico, because essentially we've destroyed our agrarian economies. And so that's why in the United States, farmers have to have a role, but it can't be just farmers because we've essentially cleared the land of farmers. And that's one of the problems we have to solve. But it's going to have to be a much broader movement than that.
Yeah, that makes sense. So before we wrap up, I just want to ask, you know, we're talking about solutions and, you know, your book is called Perilous Bounty. And I guess maybe, you know, sort of the flip side of perilous would be resilient. What does, based on, you know, reporting this book and all of your reporting over the years, what is a resilient food system look like? Like what's sort of the foundation, do you think, of a system that is resilient rather than perilous?
I mean, I think one of the themes in my book is the simplification of agriculture, the sort of narrowing of the kind of crops you grow, of, you know, moving, in the case of California, this sort of big push into this highly mechanized, water-intensive almond farming, and obviously in the Midwest, it's the sort of paring away of all other crops besides corn and soybeans. And so I think the basic principle would be to move towards diversity, to move towards, more crops. You know, in the Midwest, they obviously need to add a third and a fourth crop into the rotation and bring animals back to the land. In California, I think they need to, I think if I were running California agriculture, I would say, look, let's stop trying to conquer the snack market of Asia with nuts. And let's, you know, we are one of the world's biggest Mediterranean climates. We do have these amazing water resources. Let's scale our agriculture down to the size of our water resources and focus on being this great regional source of, you know, fruits and vegetables and dairy that's not done on an industrial scale. And I think that everywhere else, as California, I think is going to have to, like, they could do what I just said, or they could continue to butt up against the reality of, you know, their water situation and also their groundwater legislation that passed in 2014 that's going to cause big limits on them anyway. And I think that we're going to see California receding as such a big source of fruits and vegetables. And that is a call for other regions to step up and, you know, build some redundancy into the system and start growing more fruits and vegetables elsewhere. And I think that is one of the victories of the farmers market / CSA / pollen marketers movement in the past 25 years, is it has given us a great basis for that. Like, when I was a kid and when you were a kid, the situation with farmers markets was way different than it is now. There's way more to build on in every region of the United States than there was 25 years ago. And I think, you know, scaling that up and using policy to figure out, hey, you know, what do our region's farmers need to produce more food for our region, and how can we make those investments? But, you know, just basically diversifying the food system is the simple way of putting it.
Yeah, absolutely. Tom, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you all so much for listening to The Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and share it. Until next time, this is Lisa Held. The Farm Report is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Just enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.